Hi, I'm Connie Loizos.
And I'm Alex Gove.
And welcome to Strictly VC Download. This is episode 2. It's Friday, February 14th. Happy Valentine's Day. Today, our guest is Brendan Wallace of Fifth Wall Ventures. But before we get to our interview with him, we're talking about this week's news.
Busy week. Brandless, an e-commerce startup that raised a mint, folded. SoftBank has been on a roller coaster ride, and the government is more aggressively circling Silicon Valley in search of answers about whether big tech has been employing anti-competitive practices.
Yes. So I guess we could start with Brandless then. This is a company that was of particular interest to those in Silicon Valley, I think because it was based here, because it's co-founding CEO Tina Sharkey is kind of a dynamo, and because it had a different kind of offering. This company was selling food and beauty and personal care products, but it said it made every item in a way that was non-genetically modified, kosher, fair trade, gluten-free, organic, et cetera, et cetera. And in another marketing decision that some might have thought was smart, some might have thought was sort of gimmicky, everything was priced at $3 across the board. So they have this offering, the company's sort of chugging along, and then within maybe a year or two of its founding, SoftBank shows up.
Yeah, SoftBank supposedly invested $240 million. We found out later that it actually only invested $100 million, but a remarkable amount of money for a small company to absorb, and apparently it was too much money. The other issues that I can see with the company is the fact that pricing everything at $3 is a little bit difficult unless you have very strong control over your supply chain and are able to source the right goods. Also, the fact that they were trying to go after so many different markets, it would seem that it might have been a better idea to see how their value prop played in targeted markets first before going so wide.
Yeah, those are great points. And in fact, I think The Information published a report around the time that SoftBank's involvement was announced saying that they did in fact have quality control issues like serving spoons that detached from their handles, glass containers that arrived broken, and et cetera, et cetera. And they did at some point bring in a consumer veteran, John Rittenhouse, who had spent several years as a C-suite executive at Walmart nearly 20 years ago. But I guess that was not enough to kind of right the ship because he quietly left last December.
SoftBank was at the center of another big story this week, Sprint. Connie?
Yes. So this SoftBank-related story is actually a much bigger deal. SoftBank has owned something like 80% of the wireless carrier Sprint since 2013. But Sprint wound up being not such a great investment. I think it was and has continued to remain a poorly run company. It's been losing money for years. To recover its investment and hopefully make some money, SoftBank CEO Masayoshi Son has for years been pushing the company to merge with another stronger, better performing wireless carrier. So in 2018, Sprint and T-Mobile agreed to a $26 billion all stock merger. So it kind of looked like this crazy bet had paid off big time, except a flag was soon thrown. It happened last summer. State attorneys general filed a lawsuit to block the merger, saying that when it comes to corporate power, bigger isn't always better. This was sort of led by New York's Attorney General Letitia James, and she was concerned that the combined companies would be too powerful and thus cut access to affordable wireless service. So here's SoftBank. It's throwing around tons of money with its Vision Fund. A lot of these bets are going sideways or it's writing them off, as with Brandless. There's another dog walking company called Wag. It invested hundreds of millions of dollars in Wag before walking away. So it really needs this Sprint T-Mobile deal to work out. Well, once again, earlier this week, news comes down that seemed to redeem SoftBank. A judge ruled in favor of the merger. And it's sort of interestingly, he ruled in favor because he said both Sprint and T-Mobile are so troubled that to his mind, they didn't represent the kind of threat that worried the state's attorneys in the first place. Alex, I don't know if you saw, but The Verge had a headline that was pretty funny. It said, the court let T-Mobile buy Sprint because Sprint completely sucks.
That's called damning with faint praise, or in Silicon Valley, they say, tying together two leaky boats.
Exactly. That is exactly what it was. But not that SoftBank cared, because immediately after this was announced, everyone's shares went soaring. I think Sprint's shot up like 70%. T-Mobile shot up. SoftBank saw its shares rise more than 13%. I'm sure like the mood inside of SoftBank was very festive. So everybody's partying, excited. That's great. Except there is a new and major wrinkle on the story. So just as Sprint is majority owned by SoftBank, T-Mobile has a parent company, Deutsche Telekom. And Deutsche Telekom owns 60% of T-Mobile shares. And on the judge's decision this week, Deutsche Telekom basically said, like, hang on a second. It basically wants to cut the $26 billion price that the two sides on agreed 2 years ago because Sprint is terrible and its performance has deteriorated. So I don't know what this means. SoftBank, unsurprisingly, does not want to renegotiate. It kind of looks like it could be relegated once again to this kind of limbo. And that's the last thing that SoftBank needs.
That's a sad development for SoftBank, but it does make sense that Deutsche Telekom would want to take another look at the deal. Unfortunately, I have a feeling this deal will end up in the courts once again. So in other news, on Tuesday, the FTC announced that it wanted to look at transactions that Google and Facebook completed over the last 10 years. Previously, these transactions hadn't triggered antitrust review, but the commission said it hopes to learn more about acquisition strategies and whether they are used to unfairly kill off nascent or potential competitors. It's a hot topic, and certainly there are many companies that have felt that Facebook and Google cut off different markets from letting startups participate. And Connie participated in a panel this week, the following day on Wednesday, in which San Francisco's antitrust office teamed up with Stanford to discuss these very issues. Connie, how was the panel?
It was a really interesting day. I sat on one panel, but I sat through a number of the discussions, and I thought there was a lot of food for thought throughout the day. The panel on which I sat, there were a lot of questions asked about whether there are tools that the DOJ can use to better assess whether companies are being acquired, I guess, defensively. And my position and my fellow panelists was basically no. You know, I made the point that there's no way Facebook could have imagined, I don't think at the time when it was buying Instagram, that it would be as big a company as it's become. In fact, I remember thinking at the time, and I think a lot of people sort of thought at the time, this is a very, you know, tiny company, 12 people, $1 billion. That's a lot of money to pay. And I think that the impetus for that acquisition was basically to keep it out of the hands of Twitter. And, you know, similarly, YouTube had its own reasons for wanting to sell to Google many years ago, in 2006. Primarily, it was trying to evade copyright lawsuits. So I don't think there's tools, and we talked about that a little bit. There were investors speaking throughout the day. A couple of them were far from unbiased. Michael Moritz, for example, was on a discussion with a law school professor in the morning and being asked about whether the companies, Google, Facebook, et cetera, had grown too large. And unsurprisingly, Moritz argued that there's always companies coming up to topple incumbents. He said, I've seen this again and again and again, which of course is absolutely true. I do think it's worth noting that Sequoia was in Google's Series A round and has benefited greatly from Google's growth over the years. So I don't think that he would perhaps volunteer that there's been a fundamental shift, even if he thinks that's the case.
Well, it sounds like it was a really interesting and timely topic, and we'll definitely be hearing more about this in the days and months to come. So that's the week in news. Now it's time for the interview.
We're very happy to announce as our guest this week, Brendan Wallace of Fifth Wall, a venture capital firm focused on the global real estate industry and prop tech. Brendan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'd seen in the news that you were in Singapore last week to meet with potential investors. Are you now back in the U.S.?
Yeah, so that's right. I was in Singapore meeting with our existing investors, and it was a pretty unique time to be there. Obviously, when I went, which was about 2 weeks ago, the kind of outbreak of coronavirus was fairly contained in China. But then, as you probably read, it spread pretty rapidly in Singapore. So at the moment, I'm actually kind of self-quarantining myself in my own house.
Wow. When did you arrive back in the U.S.?
I arrived back on Monday. And, you know, obviously the unique feature of the coronavirus is that certain people don't actually show symptoms either for a long period or in some cases, they're not very material. They're not very acute. Right. And so I'm just, given that we have a large team at Fifth Wall, I'm trying to be extra sensitive and thoughtful about, you know, not contaminating my whole office.
Sure. And can I ask, I mean, was getting on a plane problematic, or what did you have to do to get here?
Flying out wasn't. I flew actually originally to Tokyo, and there were people that were on a precautionary basis wearing face masks, and I did as well. But in some way, I thought that was almost overkill and unnecessary. But as I was in Japan and then subsequently went to Singapore, the numbers started to exponentially grow. And so, and especially so in Singapore. And so on the way back, I went through quite a number of temperature screenings, and I had to wear a face mask literally at all times. In Singapore, face masks and hand disinfectant and sanitizer are trading, I mean, you can't even get your hands on them. They're effectively trading on the black market. So it was a bit surreal to be there, but obviously very unique. And the country is still functioning perfectly well. And probably part of that comes from their experience with SARS. This is a country that was very much exposed to SARS earlier. So I think they know how to live with this. But I think here in America, people react a little more intensely to health scares.
Hi, Brendan. It's Alex. Does it affect their willingness to plan ahead in the future, given what's going on right now?
I don't think so. I didn't really discern any kind of apprehension. Obviously, people are cognizant of financial and broadly capital markets. But, you know, Singapore in particular is a very forward-looking country, always has been, and has a really strong view on exporting capital in some respect, and obviously partnering with managers like Fifth Wall. So I didn't really detect that. Now, that may change. What I would imagine is that the situation in China is actually a lot more dire. And in that respect, I think, you know, the business of asset management and fundraising in China is probably going to be materially different for quite some time. But I would say from my experience in Singapore, I just didn't detect that.
That might be a great place to make a segue and talk a little bit about what you guys are focusing on at Fifth Wall and how one defines prop tech. It seems like it's a huge area that's really come on strong since 2015 or 2016.
I think the way you put that, it's come on strong since 2015, is exactly right. Before Fifth Wall launched, it's not that prop tech wasn't a massive category of the venture capital ecosystem. And it shouldn't really be surprising that that was the case. Real estate is the largest industry in the US. It's 13% of US GDP. It's the largest asset class. It's the largest lending category. And I think anyone who is even familiar with the real estate industry knows that it is one of the least technologized industry. The real estate industry in particular has been a laggard as it relates to technology adoption. And so what you kind of saw starting around 2015 was this almost like an age of enlightenment where real estate CEOs recognized that they needed to have a forward stance on technology, both offensively to identify technologies that could enhance their business, but also defensively to, you know, be aware of potential disruptive threats that come from technology or technology enablement. And what was happening around that time in 2015 was you had all these startups. You had kind of I would almost call it recreational venture capital happening, where corporates, real estate owner, operator, developers were dabbling in venture, but there was no institutional capital in the space. And there was this really unique feature to real estate tech that my co-founder and I saw, which was that because real estate had been such a late adopter of technology, what constituted innovation in the space was oftentimes very simple and lightweight. As you can imagine, there's a lot of technologies, for example, that can open a door with a mobile phone. And so the technological risk, the technical risk, the kind of existential risk that you oftentimes face as a venture capitalist, you didn't often face in investing in real estate tech. However, what you did face was enormous distribution risk. So if you knew which technology that could open a door, Marriott or Heinz or British Land was going to adopt, you had a massive unfair advantage in making an investment. And so what we did was and I think it feels almost very logical in retrospect, but it was pretty novel at the time. We raised our fund from the largest owners and operators and developers of real estate, believing that we could work with them, identify the technologies they were going to adopt, and then give our investments a unfair advantage with respect to distribution, help them kind of open distribution lanes to many real estate corporates.
I remember we had talked when you raised your first fund, and I thought it was so interesting. And then, as you say, novel at the time, that CBRE, the commercial services company, was one of your LPs, Hines, the developer of office buildings, et cetera. But I understand that you also have investors in Asia as well. What is your breakdown in terms of US versus Asian investors, or is it a global LP base?
It now is a global LP base. When we started, you're exactly right, it was all US. So we actually had 8 strategic LPs in the US, and we had them across basically every subsector of the real estate industry. So Prologis, an industrial, Lennar, the largest US home builder, Hines, one of the largest office owners in the US, Equity Residential, one of the largest multifamily owners, Host Hotels, CBRE, as you said. And so what we did is we worked with those corporates, identified strategic technologies for them, and then made investments in them. And so some of the kind of high-profile partnerships that came out of that first fund were like Opendoor. So we put together this massive partnership between Opendoor and Lennar, which was, I think, really transformative both for Lennar and for Opendoor. We also structured a huge partnership between Industrious, the co-working company, and Hines, and subsequently Macerich. And so what we saw in that first fund was we were able to not only deliver strong financial outperformance, like any other venture fund, but we also delivered really high strategic value. And so the transition to international came last summer, when I recognized that the business of owning an office building in, say, Tokyo or London or New York was not altogether that different. And in fact, owners were facing many of the same technology pain points and technology opportunities. And Fifth Wall had emerged as obviously the largest investor in the space. And our model actually had this odd feature that most venture funds don't have, which is the more LPs we worked with, because we worked with these large real estate owner operators, the better our model got. It's almost like we had a network effect, or we had economies of scale. And so what I did is I raised capital from large institutional owners in markets where U.S. real estate technologies were looking to expand. In particular, we have a lot of now real estate owners in Western Europe from the U.K., France, and Spain that have invested, and literally the largest owners in Japan, China, and Singapore that have invested.
And can I ask, are these all sort of complementary? I mean, I on some level, do your LPs compete with one another? Are there like uncomfortable moments in your annual meetings?
It's a great question, and it's one we oftentimes get asked as we're fundraising, which is, why would a corporate invest in Fifth Wall, you know, when their competitors are also in the fund? And I think to answer that question, you kind of need to tell the story of corporate venture capital and the challenges that have plagued it, I think, historically. I mean, corporate venture capital, I think anyone who's in the venture capital space recognizes it generally underperforms financially. And I think more surprising, it actually underperforms strategically. And there's a lot of reasons for that. It's hard to attract talent. They don't have a committed capital base. It's that they kind of tend to be episodic, meaning they're shut down very often. Entrepreneurs and other VCs are very leery of them. There's a stigma associated with corporate venture capital. So if you take all those problems and you then take the real estate industry, which is fundamentally, I think, if you were to kind of paint industries on a spectrum, it's about as far from technology as you can get. You have real estate, which is generally a low human capital, high leverage, debt and equity financed, hard asset, cash flowing business. And you compare that to venture capital, which is a typically cash flow negative, high IP, high human capital industry. And predictably, corporate venture capital in real estate has performed exceptionally bad. It rarely delivers financial results, and it rarely delivers strategic value. And so kind of in the 90s and the 2000s, I think what you saw is kind of an old school approach to corporate venture capital, where corporates would say, I want to invest in a particular technology because I don't want my competitors to get access to it. I want to structure anti-commercial, anti-competitive agreements with this company and perhaps ultimately buy it. What that did is it let them do that, but they got massive adverse selection. The companies that wanted to partner only with one real estate owner were typically not the companies you want to be partnered with anyway.
They're not thinking in terms of a bigger market.
Exactly. The most important thing in investing time and money and attention in a space like venture is it has this massive distribution dynamic where what you care about is getting access to the best companies. And corporates rarely, if ever, get access to the best companies. What happens is that generalist venture capital funds typically get access to the best companies. And so what Fifth Wall proposed is, look, you can continue doing corporate venture, although I don't think it's a great idea for real estate owners to pursue that financially or strategically, but use us as an outsourced vehicle. So you can kind of push some capital to us. We're going to be structured like an independent venture capital fund. We'll have an arm's length relationship with you, and we're going to get access to the best companies. And the reason we'll get access to the best companies is that I don't just offer distribution or partnerships just to one firm. I offer it to many. So, for example, in some categories now in our fund too, we have almost the entire industry invested in Fifth Wall. Like in home building, we have D.R. Horton, Lennar, Pulte Homes, and Toll Brothers. So effectively, four of the largest six home builders in the U.S. have invested with Fifth Wall. So we represent 25% of all new homes built in the U.S. The advantage that offers an early stage company is that by virtue of letting Fifth Wall invest, you can not just get access to anyone, you can get access to the whole industry. And so we actually create these network effects and open these distribution lanes for our startups.
Are your partners seeing the ROI from these investments yet, or is it too early in the process for that ROI to be realized?
I think they're seeing it in a very meaningful way. You know, we've structured, I think, across our portfolio close to 80 partnerships, and that's with many different portfolio companies. And now we work with 54 corporate LPs in 11 countries. So we're actually structuring partnerships that are not only helping them accelerate the business of owning and operating real estate, so increasing their top line or cutting costs, but I think we've also been able to change the mindset in terms of how they approach technology and the opportunities to learn and inform their business, a kind of oftentimes an old school, late adopting technology real estate company, and really improve their organization by frankly just having exposure to these best in breed new companies. Just an example, going back to the partnership between Lennar and Opendoor, one of the aspects of that partnership was you have Lennar, which is the largest home builder in the U.S., or in the business of using raw materials to literally build and deliver homes to consumers. And then you have Opendoor, which is a liquidity platform for single-family homes. So effectively lets a consumer get a instant price on selling their home. Now, it's a slight discount to fair market value, but they get liquidity on it. And effectively what we structured between the two companies was a trade-up program whereby buyers of a Lennar home would have an effective put right on that home to Opendoor as long as they bought another home in a Lennar community. So if you look at that at a macro level, what that effectively is like the iPhone trade-up program, but for homes. So it lets Opendoor get guaranteed volume because they're able to get all these homes that Lennar is building. And when someone wants to go from a three-bedroom house to a four-bedroom house, as long as they stay within a Lennar community, they get to sell that home at an advantage price. And from Lennar's perspective, they get to retain their customers. So if they sell them a three-bedroom house, they can be more confident they'll sell them a four-bedroom house. So a massive strategic ROI on the deal. And also, I think correspondingly, there's been an amazing financial return, both for Fifth Wall, for Lennar, and for Opendoor.
Opendoor took a lot of money from SoftBank. Was that ever a concern for you that it was taking on maybe more money than it could digest? Or what do you think of that partnership?
I don't want to speak, you know, in particular for Opendoor. But what I would say is SoftBank generally was a juggernaut in, you know, the venture capital ecosystem. And the fact that they had so much capital and that they could use that capital to effectively create a barrier to entry for certain companies, I think was very unique. And it was certainly a moment in time where a lot of companies were chasing a SoftBank investment because of the, you know, the amount of capital it conferred, but also symbolically what the message it sent to competitors. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that, you know, was very attractive for us about Opendoor is that, one, we entered, you know, a few rounds before SoftBank, but also they have a syndicate of some of the most, you know, top tier generalist venture capital investors. And I think where companies probably would struggle the most is companies that have sole exposure to SoftBank. WeWork being, I think, the most extreme example of that.
Well, actually, Benchmark, they had some really great investors early on, but I mean, sort of like Open Door, which I think is backed by what, Coastal Ventures, among others. But it's I appreciate your point. You know, I also wanted to ask you with regard to Open Door, do you draw a distinction? You know, Alex asked earlier on, like, how you define prop tech. Is like construction tech its own ball of wax, or is that also sort of part of what you're funding?
The way we define our mandate is any technology that can be strategic to the real estate industry. And so obviously that is a broad mandate, but I think definitionally it includes everything that you think of as prop tech. And so companies like VTS in our portfolio, leasing and asset management software, fit squarely within that. And then as you kind of venture out from there, you can kind of look at real estate related fintech. So Fifth Wall is one of the biggest investors in Open Door and Blend in the mortgage technology space, and Hippo in the digital home insurance space, and States Title in the title insurance space. So that's kind of a real estate related fintech. We also have made a lot of investments around data and analytics, security, facial recognition, because all of those things are hugely impactful to the real estate industry. And I'll give probably a more extreme example of where that edge or the periphery of that mandate lies. So we actually made an investment in Lime, the scooter company, which I think clearly does not seem like real estate tech. But when you look at that business, a huge part of it depends on distribution to where consumers are, which is real estate assets, and establishing charging stations and docking stations at those assets. And so what we recognized very early on was that there's a huge real estate dependency to the scooter business, that you need to have a network of charging stations, you need to structure relationships and deals with landlords, and you also need to be able to deliver these devices in an organized way at these consumer endpoints, at malls, at office buildings, at multifamily buildings. And so that was really something we thought we could be extremely strategic to, and I think the other venture funds in that deal thought we could as well.
That's really interesting. So have you facilitated any sort of partnerships between Lime and some of these major building owners?
Yeah, you can actually read about it. There's an article in TechCrunch on the partnership we structured between Lime and Macerich, where they now have charging stations and docking stations. They even opened a store with Macerich. So there's a lot of real estate dimensionality to any form of transportation. And when you look at a new modality of transportation like Lime, having relationships with real estate owners like Macerich, for example, is really important. And the reason is that Santa Monica Place, which is Macerich's asset in Santa Monica, is the most visited asset in Santa Monica. So we have enormous amounts of foot traffic through there. They're one of the largest taxpayers in Santa Monica, so obviously influential. And real estate owners tend to be fairly well connected politically. And as you know, government relations is a very big part of the scooter business.
Speaking of the political connections that some of these partners have and also some of the political mandates, I'm really curious about your carbon impact fund. It sounds like one big impetus of the fund was to help your partners address new regulations, but there also seems to be a very strong moral imperative in the way that you're talking about the fund. And so I'm just interested if you could explain the investment thesis behind it.
Yeah, so I cannot talk about the fund specifically, but what I can talk about is how real estate owners are looking at sustainability technology and kind of green tech broadly, because I think it wasn't an area that the real estate industry previously focused on. But what you've seen in the last, it really has been kind of the last 3 years, is this convergence of forces around sustainability for the real estate industry. The first is just public attention. Obviously, the climate crisis has become increasingly topical. It's kind of front and center to almost every geopolitical conversation that's being had right now. So I think that is escalating. I think part and parcel to that, the real estate industry hadn't really had a spotlight shown on it with respect to its environmental impact. So the real estate industry is responsible for 40% of all energy consumption, 30% of all greenhouse gases, 40% of all raw materials. It is one of the larger contributors to the climate crisis. And that should come as no surprise. It's a large industry, and we live in real estate. But I think what's also happened around this kind of public side of it is that tenants, really forward-looking, progressive tenants of space, like Google or Netflix, they're going to landlords and saying, we won't lease space in your asset unless you conform to new, much more stringent environmental standards. So it's actually affecting the demand for real estate. So I would take all that as one bucket of public attention. There's a second bucket, which I think is also interesting, which is the capital market side of it. So large pension funds and buyers of REIT stock and real estate lenders have said, we will preferentially deploy capital to low or no carbon impact real estate. And so there's actually a cost of capital advantage for real estate owners who are build more sustainable assets. And that doesn't even take into account the fact that insurance costs are obviously lower for more sustainable assets. But one last one, which I think is the, it's really when the pin dropped, and it happened last year. So last year, obviously Trump previously had pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord, but what local jurisdictions did is they put their cities back in it. They applied the Paris standards to cities. And so in New York, it was the first city to do so. They enacted a carbon neutrality law, which basically says all commercial real estate assets need to be carbon neutral by 2030. And there's a series of sliding scales, but you effectively start paying fines as early as 2024. And the same is actually now true roughly in Los Angeles. And so the government just stepped in and said, real estate owners need to be carbon neutral. You asked the question from the perspective of a moral imperative, and I think that's absolutely there. There's an element of altruism. There's an element of protecting our future. But I actually think the true driver of it right now is a financial imperative for real estate investors. Make no mistake, we are front and center to what is happening in the real estate industry and the collision with technology. And this is the single most important thing that has happened to the real estate industry in like the last five decades. The real estate industry is going to have to go carbon neutral.
On a practical level, how do they do that? What are some of the sort of retrofits that they're making most immediately?
So it's a lot of things, but I'll try to kind of, you know, bucket it or frame it. You know, one part of it you could kind of broadly define as like energy efficiency technology. So anything that helps you use less energy in an asset. So that's both what we think of as like smart industrial IoT. So, you know, systems that basically can turn off your HVAC units more efficiently, operate your water coolers better, operate your elevators better, use data about the building to just drive down the amount of energy you're using at the asset. So that's kind of number one. And there's a lot of components to that. I think the other big component to it is actually alternative energy itself. So, you know, broadly like solar is a huge part of that. California, for example, mandated solar on new homes. So it's actually generating your energy from alternative sources. And the third is just materials tech. So there's a lot of really smart materials that can enable a building to both in its construction and in its operation, use less or just have less of a carbon footprint. And so it's almost like this renaissance of what was, you know, green tech or clean tech back in the day. And I think a lot of people that, you know, have been in venture capital for a while would say, well, I feel like I've seen this movie before. You know, I'm sure you know, green tech was very much in vogue 10, 15 years ago. And, you know, a lot of the funds raised for it didn't really pan out, but a lot's changed since then.
You described eloquently why real estate tech became sort of sexy as it did in 2015 and 2016. I do think WeWork played a big role in that and drawing attention to the space. I just wonder if it's sort of very public stumbles of the fall have impacted the space at all. If it's sort of like attracted any skepticism or if not to real estate broadly, maybe to co-working.
It's a great question because WeWork was this company that achieved a valuation that I think everyone was scratching their heads at. And, you know, then it came back to earth very suddenly. So a few things about WeWork. One, it really wasn't an innovative business model whatsoever. The business of master leasing space and then chopping that space up, densifying it and subleasing it, this has been done for decades. So it was, I think, puzzling from our perspective when, you know, we were talking to our owners as to why WeWork commanded such, I don't know, attention and brand equity from the venture community. It was a unique role, unique position or vantage point to be in at Fifth Wall, because we were hearing real estate owners say, we've seen this movie before. We know how it ends. It ends badly. And I don't understand why this company is raising so much money. So in one ear, we were hearing that. And in the other ear, we were hearing, you know, venture capitalists who were lauding the company and saying it was this, you know, amazing, using the using words like disruptive technology company, just things that it patently was not. So when we looked at that, on the one hand, we were like, WeWork is really not all that novel or new. However, what has changed was, you know, when WeWork was growing, it caught this secular tailwind of what is broadly called like flex office. So instead of just leasing space for 5 or 10 years, giving tenants more flexible access to space, shorter term leases, more flexibility in those leases, more open seating plans, just the ability to kind of fungibly use space, both as a landlord and a tenant. That's a trend called flex office. Right now, flex office represents about 1% of the US office market. Most estimates have it growing to about 10% or more over the next decade. So you're talking about a massive increase. And WeWork was at the cutting edge of that. They were the biggest company that were riding this wave, although their business model was not really unique. So when we looked at the space, we said, we like the thematic trend. We like the secular tailwinds behind flex office. What we believe is that instead of a master lease model, which isn't unique, why don't we instead approach it from the perspective of a management company model? So where you actually just manage the space. You don't take on any long-term liabilities. You simply manage, operate, and market the space on behalf of real estate owners. And that was actually what Industrious did. So Industrious is actually quite different than WeWork, even though they're oftentimes lumped together. They have radically different business models. WeWork has long-term liabilities and short-term assets. And any historian of financial crises will know how that typically ends, whether it's a bank or a co-working company or any kind of business. Industrious is purely management contracts, or largely management contracts. And what that means is it doesn't grow quite as fast, but it also doesn't take on the same long-term liabilities, and it has a much more stable relationship with the landlord, because the landlord wants them in there to actually manage their space. They don't want to lease space to tenants of, you know, 1 to 10 employees. They want someone else to do that. And so they are lumped together. And I think WeWork's demise has changed sentiment for real estate tech broadly, but it feels a little bit out of sync with the reality of, frankly, how well many of the companies in real estate tech are doing.
I don't see a downturn necessarily happening in the next 2 months, but it's coming eventually, I think. How do you sort of plan for that? Because real estate seems sort of, you know, particularly susceptible to a turnaround.
It's a great question that I think anyone who gives an answer for is trying to give an answer for, because you can't really prepare as a equity-only investor for a downturn, other than being very cautious. We have the unique dynamic of, we raise capital, or about half of our $1.1 billion comes from real estate owner-operators. And real estate's a cyclical industry, and venture is a highly cyclical industry. So we have both sides of cyclicality. You know, what I think it means is we're just a lot more cautious in how we underwrite deals. Really looking at the kind of fundamental valuation of a business, and it's end state, right? So if you look at a business and where it's actually going to exit into the public markets, and how public market investors will treat a company with those characteristics, with those gross margins, with that growth trajectory, when you really focus on that, I think you'd really have to squint to see some of the valuations that were happening 2-3 years ago. I think they are coming a bit back down to earth. But what we haven't seen yet is what I would call fundamental retraction in the performance of real estate technology companies. Meaning, real estate is an industry that, you know, hasn't adopted technology, or hadn't really adopted technology until 5 years ago. And so you can imagine the revenue growth rates in our portfolio are dramatic. So valuations sometimes get out of sync with that, but the fundamental performance is there. So I think what you're just seeing is a collapse of those two things, where while fundamental performance has continued to be strong, you are seeing a retraction in venture capital markets. And in some ways, that's just leading to more rational valuations.
As you suggest, it's about time, I guess.
Yeah, it's not an altogether bad thing, right, to be a venture capital fund when markets are cooling. We obviously want to support entrepreneurs and, you know, invest at the right valuation, but yeah, I think it's a good time to be, you know, deploying capital right now, because I think the luster of some of these, you know, high flying companies where they didn't have really an original approach, WeWork probably being a prime example, that luster is gone. And instead, investors are focusing on more fundamental characteristics of a business, like how truly unique is this, and where would public market investors value such a business in an end state?
Well, Brendan, we are so appreciative of you talking to us, especially locked down as you are, and I'm sure dealing with quite a bit.
I'm happy to chat and thrilled to be on.
And that is our program.
If you're still here, you're entitled to a crisp $5 bill.
Thank you so much for putting up with our technical snafus. It's a little bit like Wayne's World around here. Alex and I are in our baseball caps trying to figure out what the beep we're doing.
Yeah, we're really making it up as we go along, as you can tell.
Thanks again. We'll see you next week.